Hello, welcome back. And the album years has reached 1987, and this is part two of 1987. We've already covered a fair bit of that year. We've covered mainstream, goth, electro variations, singer-songwriter and Mavericks. We're going to start this episode, Tim, part two of 1987, discussing something that I think will be fascinating to explore this topic. Mm-hmm. The idea of 70s artists that kind of lost their way a bit in the 80s or went a bit mad or tried things out that didn't quite come off. And 1987 has got
an abundance of them.
Well, I mean, arguably some of these are more successful than others, mm-hmm. in terms of pulling off what they set out to do, maintaining their audience, achieving commercial success. I mean, one example of one that probably ticked all of those boxes is the Pink Floyd record from this year, A Momentary Lapse of Reason, which I really like. And it's one of the interesting things about this record. I bought it at the time and I was disappointed. Mm-hmm. In fact, you were talking in the previous episode about how you were initially disappointed by the Sylvian record from 87. You came to appreciate it later. I think initially I was disappointed with A Momentary Lapse of Reason. I mean, this is a band that have set the bar extremely high, isn't it? In terms of what you expect from a Pink Floyd record. And I was disappointed with it because it felt, obviously the main thing it was missing was it didn't have that edge that the Roger Waters lyrics gave it. The attempts at sort of to be a little bit edgy and angry, things like Dogs of War on the album, probably the least successful track on the record for me.
Yeah.
But as I've got older, I've come to appreciate it. You know, Roger Waters is not there. That element is not there. But all of the other stuff you love about Pink Floyd is still there. Gilmour's voice, his guitar playing, the textural element of Pink Floyd, the atmosphere, the sound design, the sense of conceptual flow. It's all there on this record, isn't it? Even if you can't say it's a classic Pink Floyd record, I think as part of the canon now, you kind of enjoy it. What about you?
Yeah, and I think what they did, obviously, was I think Roger Waters at the time referred to it as a forgery, a Pink Floyd forgery, and there's an element of truth in that. But it does look, feel, and sound like a Pink Floyd album. I think it misses the conceptual gravitas and lyrics of Waters. I think it also misses the grit that his voice brings to the proceedings. And as the latest version of the album attests to, in some ways, it's a little too cold in 1980s in its production. It doesn't feel like a band record. It feels like Gilmour putting together a Pink Floyd album. It's a Pink Floyd album of the imagination, in a sense, and it's in Gilmour's imagination. So it sort of feels two-thirds there, in a sense.
I mean, it kind of feels that way because that's what it is, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Nick Mason, on the original mix at least, was pretty much absent. It was mostly drum machine.
Yeah.
And Rick Wright was only brought in, I think, right towards the end to add some extra sort of overdubs, to almost to legitimise it as Pink Floyd.
Exactly.
So you're right. There is a sense that this is more of a David Gilmour solo album, certainly than the next record, The Division Bell, which felt more like a band album.
It did.
This, to me, almost seems like a natural successor to, say, Gilmour's previous solo record, About Face. In fact, a track like One Slip actually sounds less like anything Pink Floyd had done before, but actually has quite a lot in common with a couple of tracks on About Face.
Yeah.
And actually is a track that sounds a little bit more 80s. In fact, the only other record that had been made before this in the 80s, and the only other Pink Floyd record made in the 80s, The Final Cut, was almost deliberately shying away from electronics and technology, wasn't it? It was a very organic mm-hmm. record. I enjoy it. I mean, you know, I'm not going to say it's a masterpiece or one of my favourite Pink Floyd records, but I enjoy it because it's such a great... The sound of Pink Floyd is just so easy to sort of slip into, isn't it?
It is, and I think Waters does it as well on some of his solo albums. It's kind of interesting, isn't it, that Pink Floyd split. You get two potential Pink Floyd albums around these times. You know, obviously, I think Amused to Death and Division Bell, to a certain extent, are more successful for me. Division Bell does sound like more of a band album, and Richard Wright's input, I think, is really appreciated on that album. But yeah, it is in some ways a creditable Pink Floyd forgery that could have fallen completely flat on its face, but it does just enough not to. It does enough to convince the fans. It does enough to convince the general public because it sold very well. And obviously the tour it spawned, I think, gave the band a great deal of confidence. And of course, the thing is that bands do split. Members do leave. There are albums in bands' careers that perhaps only feature one or two prominent members or a different prominent two members. You know, Beach Boys are a great example of that, how Brian Wilson wrests control of one album, but the rest of the band wrests control of the next album and so on. So in that sense, it fits nicely into the Pink Floyd catalogue. And I think one of the things that helps that transition is the quality of the artwork. I think that Hypnosis, Storm Thorgerson and so on, it's probably not Hypnosis by the stage, but it's Storm Thorgerson and so on, they have packaged it in exactly the way a Pink Floyd album should be packaged.
Great cover, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. It's interesting. So let's talk about the other record from this year that came from the Pink Floyd axis, which is Roger Waters' Radio Chaos, which I think is a less successful record.
Yeah.
Part of the problem I have with Radio Chaos is that it's too short to really put across what I think he's trying to put across. It's a 40-minute record, and he's trying to tell this story about I'm kind of remembering, it's been a long time since I heard the record. It's about a guy that is in a wheelchair. He's unable to speak. He communicates through a kind of Stephen Hawking-like vocal device. His brother gets in trouble, blah, 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 blah. They move to LA. There's a nuclear war. So much happens in this record across eight songs, 40 minutes, and musically quite lightweight songs as well.
I think it's the weakest thing Waters has done by a long, long way for me. Mm. And I wasn't the greatest fan of Pros and Cons. I mean, I think it's a good...
I love
good,
that record. Yeah.
I like it, but in some ways it does sound like the cast-off album from the era of The Wall and Final Cut. It sounds lesser to me, slightly thinner in its production, but I do like it. Final Cut, as you know, I think both of us consider it to be an extraordinarily strong album. And I really liked Amused to Death and the album he did recently with Nigel Godrich. I thought was good as well.
Pros and Cons is my favourite. I mean, it's almost up there with Final Cut for me. And you probably know the history. It was written at the same time
as The Wall.
And they chose The Wall to record, and Pros and Cons was then...
I like it, and I think the overall concept is well rendered. And once more, it is a really convincing Pink Floyd universe. And of course, that's the thing, isn't it? That on Pros and Cons, Waters recreates that universe perfectly. Maybe the sound is slightly thinner with the absence of Gilmour and the absence of Wright's textures, but of course he wasn't on Final Cut anyway.
Well, but he's got Eric Clapton in on guitar, which is not a bad substitute. I mean,
I sort of prefer, weirdly enough, I think Clapton does a really good job on the album. Mm. I preferred Beck on Amused to Death, and I kind of prefer Gilmour, just his tone and approach. And this is Gilmour's version of a Pink Floyd album. And to be fair, with both Pros and Cons and A Moment of Lights of Reason, they could both be released as Pink Floyd albums and no one would think anything of it, both of them. But I think you're right, this year Gilmour wins.
I think the problem with Radio Chaos is also that this is the difference between Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking, the previous solo record, and Radio Chaos, is that Radio Chaos does attempt to go with the times in terms of the technology, and it just feels a little bit forced. There's no, I don't hear any songs there really. The songwriting rigor isn't there. So it's all kind of bells and whistles and sort of window dressing.
Yeah.
And there's not enough musically there to kind of support this, I mean, a concept that kind of encapsulates everything from physical disability to nuclear war to the... How can you possibly deal with that in eight relatively slight, by his standards, relatively slight pop songs?
And I think as well, it's just too complex a concept, full stop. I think the beauty of Pink Floyd's albums is that their concepts generally tended to be almost mood-like in some ways, but also very easy to explain. You know, you can probably explain Wish You Were Here, Dark Side of the Moon, even The Wall to an extent, in a couple of sentences to somebody.
Yeah.
You've struggled in about 50 sentences to get this across to me.
Well, because I'm not quite sure what it is about, to be honest.
Nor am I.
I don't think anyone
nor was
is.
I.
Yeah. But I mean, pros and cons of hitchhiking, for example, is also a concept record that, that kind of plays out in 40 minutes. But it's essentially, the concept is there's a bloke asleep and he's having this weird kind of surreal dream.
Yes.
And that's it. And it plays out in real time, which I think is a beautiful kind of, you know, conceit to have the each track is timed, is named after the time of the night, the part of the dream. So like 5:17 a.m. So it's happening in real time. It's a lovely concept. Whereas this is, as you say, it's so ambitious. It seems to be almost too big for its own boots in terms of what he's trying to encapsulate in this. And also the conceit of having the radio DJ, the radio disc jockey. There's so many things. And it's almost like he's throwing everything at the wall in an attempt to distract you from the fact there aren't any songs.
And it is the only time, as you point out, that he really embraced the era in a way that's quite uncomfortable and quite fake. Because what I think distinguishes Pros and Cons and Final Cut is that in an era of big production, big reverb, these albums are classic and timeless in a Floydian way. Of course, they employ production techniques, but they're very logical variations on what Waters and Floyd had done before. Mm. Whereas this sounds like he's attempting to embrace the zeitgeist and not quite managing it.
Also, I don't think Roger Waters does positive or optimistic. I mean, there's one track on the album, the last track, The Tide Is Turning, yes, after Live Aid. I don't think he does inspirational, optimistic positivity. It just doesn't sit well with Roger Waters somehow. I mean, he was obviously very moved by the whole, apparently very moved by the whole Live Aid thing. But it does. It almost doesn't fit him to be positive and sentimental.
No, and A Momentary Lapse of Reason, while it's not got a clear concept, it seems like it's got a clear concept. It seems to buy into some way this idea that Floyd always evoked alienation, slightly troubled mentality, isolation. And the album manages to do that. And also it does have quite an 80s sound, actually. You know, there are techniques that Floyd haven't used on the album.
Yeah.
Some of the rhythms, for example, are quite un-Floyd-like. Mm. I think there isn't a use of kind of marimba at one point, you know, or synthetic marimba.
Yeah, one slip. Yeah, I think it's one of the best tracks.
Yes, I agree with you. Yeah. It's actually bringing in a new voice to Pink Floyd and a sort of 80s contemporary voice, but it works. You know, obviously the drum and rhythm production is a little thin, I think, but that's very much of its era, you know, in the way that Cars records of that era always sound a little thin in some ways.
And there's a couple of bona fide Floyd classics on the Floyd record. Sorrow, you know, has become almost like a standard for them.
Yeah.
And On the Turning Away, the sort of power ballad, mid-80s power ballad, it's quite convincing in a way that I don't feel that way about The Tide Is Turning on the Roger Waters album as a sort of convincing 80s power ballad. My feeling ultimately is that although Pink Floyd was very much a gestalt thing, that they were much stronger together than they were apart, generally speaking, I feel Gilmour has missed Roger Waters a lot less than Roger Waters has missed David Gilmour and Richard Wright and the musicality that he brought. Because I think he is so limited as a musician. And at the end of the day, you can be the greatest conceptualist and the greatest lyric writer on earth. If you can't write memorable tunes and you don't have the musicality to be able to arrange those tunes in a way that will appeal, you're stuffed. Whereas actually, you could have the worst lyrics in the world, but if they're in the context of an amazing piece of music, it actually doesn't matter that much.
You know? Yes, of course.
It doesn't matter that much. How much do people really, you know, listen to lyrics at the end of the day in the context? And I'm not suggesting that David Gilmour's lyrics are terrible at all. They're not terrible. They're not on the same level of Roger Waters' lyrics, but it doesn't matter so much. But what does matter is when you're trying to make an album like Radio Chaos and you've really got no tunes and you've got nobody that's kind of sort of pushing you into more musical areas and trying to arrange the music in more interesting ways.
But I think, you know, that's it. I think it's the openness to being changed in some ways. But Waters clearly was open to being changed because the production is very contemporary. So someone was having an impact on the album that isn't typically Waters. So in that sense, he's being shifted. But like you, I think with Momentary Lapse of Reason, I remember buying it. I think I've, you know, told the story before of, you know, I bought Never Let Me Down and Momentary Lapse of Reason on the same day.
Well, let's talk about Never Let Me Down. Yeah.
Because and it being devastating at the time, because to me, I didn't have particularly high expectations, but even those expectations were in some ways.
It failed, Never Let Me Down failed to live up to your very low expectations.
I was just going to say, like you, with Motorhead, the reason I wasn't wholly convinced. But weirdly, it's got a nagging insistence, and I like it more than I did. And I thought the new, more organic version of it that was released a couple of years ago was pretty good. So, yes, it's never going to be up there with Animals, Dark Side, Wish You Were Here, The Wall, but it's not bad.
So, are you saying, Tim, that A Momentary Lapse of Reason and Never Let Me Down by David Bowie came out on the same day? Because you bought them on the same day.
Well, I certainly bought them on the same day, so maybe they did come out on the same day.
You wouldn't have hung around to buy a David Bowie record.
I'd have been out. I'd have been, you know, like a greyhound out of the traps.
Yeah, because those were the
running
days.
Running to Warrington Arprice, running from the village outside of Warrington, over the swing bridge that used to have vinyl albums hanging from it.
Yeah.
By rope.
Copies of Egg, Civil Surface.
I never did that with Civil Surface. I couldn't have done that.
You told me.
Might have told you that as an exaggeration.
You told me you lined a phone box in Stockton Heath.
Yeah, we lined phone boxes.
With copies of Egg records.
I would never insult Dave
Your
Stewart
cousin
like that.
Gave me his just tossed his whole Soft Machine collection in my with disdain. He tossed it in my drawer. Here, you take it. I don't want this shit. So I can well believe that you were lining telephone boxes with copies of Egg.
You were lucky they hadn't cooked it.
So there you are, rushing over the swing bridge in
rushing
Stockton Heath,
over the swing bridge to the Arprice
to buy your copy of A Momentary Lapse of Reason and. You've been saving up your pocket money all week.
Like
all
a greyhound, month. Out of the traps.
And Never Let Me Down by David Bowie. You're rushing back. Which one do you put on first?
Then I run back.
You run back. Which one do
Probably
you put on first?
Probably even faster.
Which one do you put on first?
Good question. I think I might have put on the Bowie first.
Right. And what sort of emotions did you go through as you were hearing? Because it's a rotten record, isn't it? It's rotten.
It is rotten. And this, of course, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? These two albums released on the same day, the ones that gave me a terrible headache and possibly a 6-month depression. They've both been redone over the last few years.
Right.
So this was on one of the David Bowie box sets. A producer and a few arrangers were doing very different alternative versions of Never Let Me Down, saying, well, actually, this album's misunderstood. The songs are very strong. David was actually operating at a very high creative level.
And?
It's Never Let Me Down with string quartets and a few more interesting atonal guitars.
It's slightly better, but it's a bit
slightly
of
more organic
polished turd.
There is an aspect. I mean, it's you know, to be fair, it's David Bowie. I always love his voice. But, you know, this is Bowie at his least interesting, most reduced. He barely seems there. It's behind the times of the 80s at that point in the same way that Neil Young's equivalent albums are, you know, contemporaneous albums. Yeah, it was a savage disappointment. And obviously it also had the embarrassment of the Glass Spider piece.
The tour as well.
There's a spoken word piece which isn't quite the spoken word piece on Diamond Dogs, and at least Diamond Dogs, it gets away with it partly because the album is great, but also the overarching concept is more interesting. Glass Spider is slightly incomprehensible folly, really, which normally I'm all for. But
is it his absolute career nadir?
This and Tonight are the career
but Tonight
nadirs.
See, I have to be honest, I've never heard Never Let Me Down. I have heard Tonight. Yeah. Tonight has Loving the Alien on it. It must surely be better than Never Let Me Down by virtue of having that track on it.
It has the worst things he's ever done, including the title track, which is a version of a track I think he did with Iggy Pop. Might even be Iggy Pop written. Loving the Alien was wonderful.
Hmm. There's nothing as good as that.
Blue Jean's a great single.
Blue Jean
in
is
its own
great,
way.
Like the video as well.
And around that time, he's writing some fantastic pieces. Absolute Beginners is really good. The material he writes for Labyrinth is all right. The track he co-writes with Pat Metheny, This Is Not America, is
like that,
absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. And then, of course, he also writes something along with Roger Waters.
When the Wind Blows.
When the Wind Blows.
Yeah.
And When the Wind Blows, it's a really experimental, interesting piece of music. And maybe that's why I had my hopes up with this, because he'd written This Is Not America, Absolute Beginners, When the Wind Blows, things that I would put on a decent Bowie compilation. I suppose the thing with this album is none of it's truly, truly terrible. It's truly, truly mediocre. With the exception of the Glass Spider spoken word concert piece, it's all mediocre nothingness that's a little difficult to remember. It's a kind of 80s nothingness that's maybe 3 or 4 years technologically behind the times. He doesn't feel like he's on it.
Right. Okay. Which is not what you expect.
In there.
Not what you expect from someone that always seemed to be ahead of the game in a way, and anticipating rather than following trends. Yeah.
Whereas the Floyd was, okay, they're trying to do this, they're trying to do that. You know, there was a very strong element that this was a very well-considered forgery at the time.
Let's carry on with this concept of 70s artists, the difficult years, the difficult 80s for 70s artists. Big Generator by Yes. Let's discuss these two together, otherwise we'll never get off this topic. Big Generator by Yes and Crest of a Nave by Jethro Tull, one of which I've heard, one of which I haven't. I haven't heard the Jethro Tull album. I have heard the Yes album. I bought it at the time because I'd loved 90125. One of my favourite anecdotes, and it's not completely accurate, but let's just overlook the fact it's not completely accurate, but I love this anecdote. In the time it took Yes to follow up 90125 with Big Generator, 8 songs, 40 minutes, 8 songs. The time it took them to follow that album up and record the follow-up, the Smiths formed, released 20 singles, 4 albums, 2 compilations, changed the face of alternative guitar music, at least in the UK, and broke up. A whole career in the time it took Yes to knuckle down and write 8 songs to follow up their previous hit album.
Yeah.
And it's not great, is it? It's mad in places.
I think it's not great. Marginally better than 90125.
Oh, it's nowhere near as good as 90125.
I think the title track is great. And that whole demented midsection about the Soft Machine.
There's some interesting ideas. I agree with you. The title track is the most interesting. I like this track and I like Shoot High, Aim Low, or whatever it's called, which has got a glorious sort of harmonies on the chorus. And then there's a couple of attempts later on in the record to try and recapture some of their progressive rock roots.
Or just the old, I'm Running, I think it is, and Holy Lamb, which are just very... Holy Lamb is a very pretty, ethereal John Anderson ballad, which sounds as good as many he's written. I'm Running almost kind of reclaims the territory of the first couple of Yes albums. It's a real anomaly on that record. It has a kind of a 60s underground quality rather than your kind of classic progressive.
And then there's a few AOR sort of, very FM rock AOR sort of things, which are totally interesting to me.
I mean, the one thing I'd say is that 90125 is much more focused as an album overall, but I think it's slightly less charming and a lot less mad.
I don't think Big Generator's very good. I think it's overwrought, overthought, overworked, overproduced, and actually it sounds quite thin. And it's interesting because Trevor Horn didn't mix it. Trevor Rabin mixed it himself. So Trevor Horn, as far as I understand, kind of disappeared from the scene some way during the sessions. I mean, listen, the whole landscape of music changed completely between, when was 90125, 82? Mm-hmm. What sounded like the future in 1982, 83, I beg your pardon. What sounded like the future of music in 83, Owner of a Lonely Heart, sounds like the past in 1987.
But that's going on to what we discussed in the first episode, that for whatever reason, the ZTT sound had sort of dominated between 83 and 86. And suddenly in this year, this is why ACT, Art of Noise and Big Generator, they really don't sound cutting edge anymore.
No, right, yeah.
That I completely agree with. And it is, it's an unfocused album. And what you're hearing on this is, whereas 90125 is a curated producer's version of Yes, you feel that the band are a small part of this. With this album, it's a mixture of what the producer wants to do, what the band want to do, what maybe the label think. It really sounds, if it's... you were saying overraw, overthought, it's underconfident.
There's some good stuff on it. As I say, I like the Shoot High, Aim, whatever it's called. I can never remember the title.
Aim Low, is it?
Aim Low, yeah. And the title track, although it is kind of a slightly more avant-garde take of Owner of a Lonely Heart, even to the point that the main riff is the da-da-da-da-da. Yes. It's the same riff. It took 4 years for them to make it, which seems amazing to me, but of course would become more and more common as things moved yeah. into the future. These kind of big gaps between albums would become more and more common. But at the time, as I say, the idea that the Smiths kind of formed and broke up in the time it took Yes to record eight songs kind of tells you all you need to know, really.
I suppose the thing is that what I'd say with Big Generator, it isn't quite the disaster people say, and they are
I don't think it's a disaster. Don't
they
get me wrong.
Still yeah. inspired, you know, Big Generator is bonkers, and then when you listen to a track like Holy Lamb, Anderson can still pull off that Soon style miniature ballad. He's still got the voice. There's still got some level of inspiration, which is, you know, something other bands of that era were lacking at that stage. So even that band, that underpowered, Yes, had some element of madness and inspiration, I suppose.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a disaster at all. I don't think it's great. I don't think it's anywhere near as good as 90125.
Oh, yeah, it would be, look, it'd be probably my 50th favourite album of 1987.
And
maybe.
I never listened
150th,
and I never listened to another Yes ever again after this. So I don't know any other Yes.
It put album. You off them for life.
It kind of did. Yes were never my favourite band or anything, but I definitely enjoyed all their records, and I bought Drama when it came out, and I bought 90125 when it came out, and I thought Owner of a Lonely Heart was absolutely game-changing, dazzling, everything, mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah. I bought Big Generator when it came out, and that was it. So, Crest of a Nave by Jethro Tull. I don't know this record.
Well, it's something of a retreat from the artwork to the music. So, I really quite liked it when Anderson goes off and decides that he's Thomas Dolby, you know, on something like Under Wraps, because, again, he always personalizes it. I even, you know, like the electronic excursions on Broadside and A, you know, this isn't a particularly...
Broadside?
Broadsword
oh
and the Beast.
Oh, my God. Check out that Schoolboy era.
Yeah. Listeners. 1982, Owner of a Lonely Heart.
London Town by The Clash.
I thought was all right. So I kind of like the fact that they were changing during this decade. A lot of fans didn't, and I know the label and their management didn't. You know, they were... In a way, almost seen as being traitors for doing this. But I liked it partly because it seemed genuine. When you listen to an album like Under Wraps, lyrically it's as intelligent and searching as Anderson ever gets. There's a kind of an espionage theme. And he clearly believes in it. I think this is the thing, isn't it? Even if it's a failure and not the best work they've ever done, it's great when somebody of a certain vintage finds a totally fresh vocabulary and they believe in it. What isn't good is when people say, I'm going to do this or do that in order to gain kudos or gain fashionable status or gain success. And Crest of a Nave, which fans like a lot, the cover is almost a return to some of the classic, almost pageantry imagery and so on. And the album is much more a kind of a classic rock staple. It's very much the return of the guitar. And Anderson's voice changed dramatically. I think we've discussed this before, that when he was singing on the A tour, he had notes on his voice and he was singing in quite unusual registers.
I think it was the Under Wraps tour, yeah.
It was the Under Wraps tour. Yeah. His voice went, and it was just before this album. Mm. And his voice is at times almost unrecognisable, and at times it's like a pretty convincing Dire Straits album. That's the odd thing, you know. I suppose in some ways, he's not gone back to the Jethro Tull template of regurgitating a particular album, a particular sound, because it has, as I said, this kind of Dire Straits, certainly Love Over Gold kind of influence, and he's working within the parameters that his then voice could. Not a personal favourite, but I know a lot of people really, really like it. But it is, it's almost Jethro Tull returning to a kind of a classic rock status after being almost electropop.
It sounds like Ian, I mean, I haven't heard the record, but it sounds like Ian was still, or the band was still kind of aware of what was going on around them. And it's interesting, you know, if you look at the albums they made in the 80s, so Under Wraps was kind of a response to synth pop. And here's another example of the band kind of responding. Dire Straits probably at the time, was it Brothers in Arms
kind of era? Yeah.
probably responding to the fact that this was the big record of the time and trying to channel through that, channel that through their own sensibility and to make a record that would appeal to that audience. And I think Ian was always quite canny with those kind of things.
Sure.
Responding to the shifts in musical genre and musical tastes as the 80s went on. And
it shows a very different side to Martin Barr. You know, he can be this kind of sensitive, Knopfler-esque blues soloist. I mean, he's a really good guitarist.
He's an amazing guitarist.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But it's showing a different side to his playing. I suppose with this album, actually, I think you're right. They are responding to the time still. They're not entirely retreating and becoming a Jethro Tull tribute act. It's just, I was never the world's greatest Dire Straits fan. Therefore, it's not necessarily for me. Whereas when they were adopting electropop, I was a huge fan of the likes of Thomas Dolby and so on.